So I decided to give a talk on an old staple, a very easy subject, the meaning of life. Because with a talk like that, you can usually talk about anything and see what comes up. And it is important. You know that one of the reasons I give these talks, I just remembered that just before I came in there, one person just asked me, he's got lots of pains in his body, and said, what's the purpose of having these pains? Because when unpleasant things happen to you in life, especially unpleasant things, we always try and ask the question, why? Why is this happening to me? Why do I have to endure this? What, you know, is this what life is all about? It's amazing how many people ask, what is the meaning of life when life is difficult? But how many of you ask, what is the meaning of life when you're having a good time? Well, actually, both should be investigated so we can actually find out, you know, what is the purpose of our life? Because if we don't know the purpose of our life, very often we don't live life with a purpose when we don't know a purpose. And when you don't live life with a purpose, that sometimes that we just wander around, we could live a pretty meaningless existence, and in the end we sort of get depressed and sad and think, well, what have I spent my life doing? What's the point of all of this? It's one of those questions which, you know, science can't answer, and psychology struggles to find an answer. But as religious people, we really always have some sort of answer, but some of the answers which religions give, you know, doesn't really make much sense. And I'm more like the spiritual answers. I know that sometimes people ask me that question, you know, is Buddhism a religion? Or is it just a way of life? Is it a philosophy? And I always answer that Buddhism is a religion, especially when we're applying to the government for tax exemption. At other times it can be a philosophy or a way of life. We've got to be practical. But certainly that it goes much deeper than anything you can read in a book, and also anything which is a dogma, because that's what books are. They just tell you dogmas, things to believe. And we use those books as like maps, but remember the map is not the territory, as they say. Those books are just signposts pointing at something, and I much prefer to go to the territory itself and start talking about that. So like living life with some sort of meaning and some sort of purpose. Again, I remember one lady in Singapore about a month ago. She's about to get married. And you'd think that at that time in her life that she would be quite excited, but actually she was quite worried and concerned. And this is what she said, now, what is the purpose of life? I'm about to get married. Now, what's the meaning of this? And I really valued her question because it was coming at a time when she was quite happy and she had something to look forward to. But she didn't know quite what it was she was going to look forward to. I read only a few days ago that people said that marriages are made in heaven, but then so is thunder and lightning as well. We had some this morning. But, and I said one straight answer, which was a very deep answer, but which leads on to other questions, and that's, you know, sometimes the right answer to make you look more deeply. So the purpose of life is finding the purpose of life. This is almost the purpose is actually the search to find out, you know, what this means. And that's an important part of life. Because as human beings, we will always be asking that question, why, always searching, trying to find out, trying to understand. And that's such an important part of life. That is almost like a purpose, to try and find out, what is this life all about? Who are you? Why are you? And what are these emotions which run our lives? What are they? And that finding the purpose, searching, you know, not becoming philosophical, because philosophical is just a game played with concepts and words, but being more experiential, to find out, you know, how you feel and what is these things. And that's actually where like a spirituality like Buddhism is very, very strong, because, you know, we always do want to find out. One of the great things with this path is you can ask any question whatsoever, and every question is respected, no matter how stupid you think it is. The very fact it's a question asked from a sincere place means it's respected. So we can ask questions to find out deeper answers and to find out the question why. And indeed, that one of the questions which I always remember the answer to. It wasn't my answer, it came from another monk in England who was once asked by a pair of English Buddhists. They just had their first child. And they asked the question, now we've had a son, how should we bring him up? We're both Buddhists, but we don't want to indoctrinate our child. Should we take our child to the Buddhist temple when he grows up? Or should we take him to the Buddhist temple on Saturday, and the church on Sunday, the mosque on Monday, the Hindu temple on Tuesday? There's enough religions and cults actually to fill out a whole week. Actually, a whole month probably. Or should we just leave him alone and not take him to any church or religion at all and just leave him to be? They said, all those alternatives don't make any sense to us. We don't want to indoctrinate our child. We don't want to confuse our child by taking him to all sorts of religions. But then again, we want to help our child. It's our duty to try and encourage him. And this monk gave a wonderful answer. And this is an answer which, you know, each one of you can take on board as well, because now, it's a question which we can relate to. His answer was, teach your child two things. Teach him to be honest and to question. Those are the only two things you need to encourage in your child. Because as long as he's honest, he will always be not just honest to others, but honest to himself, and more importantly, honest to truth. So he will never take anything which is obviously nonsense. He never believe anything which makes no sense, which flies in the face of reason and experience. He will never believe, you know, some of the sayings in some of the scriptures, like, you know, like a person built a boat and had two of every type of animals for 40 days. And some of those ideas are complete absolute nonsense. And sometimes it concerns me that some people who have had an education can believe such nonsense, which flies completely against reason. I mean, it's dangerous when people do believe in such extreme things. Because of that, it's wonderful if we encourage honesty, first of all, which is a commitment to truth, no matter what. And even, you know, the Dalai Lama was quoted as saying, he was asked that question once, you know, if science comes along and disproves some very fundamental parts of Buddhism, what would you do? And he said, I'd give up those fundamental parts of Buddhism. And that was like an answer which is almost fundamental to Buddhism, in the sense that, you know, truth, reality, always has to take precedence over any theory or dogma which we have. So we have to be honest to our experience and honest to truth, and even be able to discard any scriptures, any dogmas, any ideas, if it does go contrary to what is clearly the truth. So if you encourage your child to be honest, and number two, encourage your child always to question, because it's questioning is the tool by which we can always dig deeper into the reality of life and find out for ourselves what this life's purpose truly is. Now, through questioning. And that questioning means you cannot be lazy, because many people, they give up their questioning just because they get tired. And they say, well, you know, this might not be the truth, but I've had enough of all this questioning, I just want to relax and take it easy. Now, stupidity is an option for lazy people. But really, I think many of us, they can't really just rest in their lazy stupidity for too long. Eventually, we have to sort of find some sort of truth and some sort of answer. And that actually introduces laziness and stupidity is a good opportunity for today's joke, which I tried out earlier with a few people, about these two very lazy and quite sort of stupid young men who happened to be in London on a working holiday, and running out of money, they were looking for a job, and they saw an advertisement outside a police station. They needed police officers. So they thought, oh, this is a good job. Just, you know, stand by the side of the road with these lovely cameras and charge people for speeding. But anyhow, they went inside for the interview, and first of all they had to have their medical. And the first one who went in, the officer looked at him, and he was just so small and scrawny and weak, he said, well, you can't be a policeman, get out of here. It's not even worthwhile giving you a medical. And he said, well, I'm with my mate, my friend. He said, I'll just go over the road to the pub, wait for your friend over there. And then his friend went in, and it's this big guy, really strong and fit. And the sort of the officer doing the interview say, "Oh, you're just the guy we need. We need some more big, strong policemen like you. You know, I don't need to give you a medical. I'll tick all the boxes. You're fit enough. We want you in." He said, "No, we have to have the intelligence test." First question, what's 5 plus 6? He's counting his fingers. He only had 10 fingers, so it was a bit difficult. He said, "Listen, how many people play on a soccer team?" He said, 11. Well done. Correct. Next question, history. Who killed Julius Caesar? He said, "Julius who? Julius Caesar. Who killed Julius? Look, we really want, you're as good as in. You can just count yourself and got the job, but we want to get this answer. We've got to do the intelligence test. Who killed Julius Caesar?" He said, "Well, I'm not really sure." He said, "Look, it's almost lunchtime. Go over the road with your mate. Do some research. Ask a few people. And you can come in the afternoon and tell me the answer." So off he goes to the pub, and his mate says, "How did you go in the interview?" He said, "Oh, great, I'm in. In fact, they like me so much, they put me on my first murder case." Okay, it's not a good joke, but after all these years, I'm getting a bit hard up for new jokes. At least that's one I haven't told on in public before. But actually, we do have to keep... when I give these talks, usually the jokes is the only thing people come here for. Anyhow, so stupidity and laziness, sometimes we can be like spiritually stupid and spiritually lazy, not wanting to ask the questions and just believe in what other people tell us. And of course, that's not really good enough. The purpose of life is actually to find out. And we have to ask those questions. So we can question everything, but we also have to know actually where we ask those questions. And the purpose of life is not asking the intellectual, philosophical questions. We actually base the questions on our own experience of life. We start to ask those questions. What is happiness? And what is love? What is peace? What is the most important thing in life? And that's a wonderful question to ask you. What is the most important thing in your life? And we forget the answer to that question very often as we run around doing all of these busyness and all these jobs. And sometimes we forget what's important. For example, even people of religion, we can forget what's really important. Very often at interfaith meetings, I've told people the meaning of the word church in English. Church never meant a building. The church was the name for the congregation of people who met together. And sometimes they meet together in a barn. That would be the church, the people. But somehow in the history of our world, the church became identified as the name of the building in which the people met. And as soon as that became the most important thing, the building, we started building these huge edifices, great cathedrals, and spending all the money on the building and forgetting the people. Which is why many of those churches, even though they're magnificent buildings, are mostly empty. Because the meaning of the word changed from the people to the things. And to me, it's really important that the people are more important than the things. The people who come here are much more important than the infrastructure of our Buddhist society, because you are here first, the infrastructure comes second. And even in my monastery, I always keep remembering it's the people are more important than the things. So, for a good example of that, when I was in Singapore, they were doing some fundraising for me for our retreat center, which is going really well down at Serpentine. If you want to have a look on the internet, we started a bricklaying recently of our retreat center. It should be finished by the end of the year, so people can do more meditation retreats down there. But they were doing some fundraising, and because they didn't lock away the donation box, somebody stole it. And so the person's responsible, the treasurer of this Buddhist fellowship, which I look after, she came to me and she was crying and so sad. She said, "Look, it's my fault, and I don't know how many $100,000 or whatever we lost because your retreat center, because someone stole it, and I felt so terrible." And I just looked at her and said, "Look, what are these donations for anyway? These donations are there to make people peaceful and happy. They're for service." And so the point is that don't be upset about that. You're more important than any donations. People are more important than things. Now, how can you put a price on a person's happiness? So let the person have stolen that money, but please don't let them steal your happiness. That's much more important. So please never feel guilty about what happened. It wasn't intentional. It was just these things happen sometimes. You are more important than that money. That's why I prefer you just let that money go and smile again. But it's very important to remember that. Actually, there's one story which I don't know the last time I told this, but it's certainly not in my book. If I ever write a sequel to that book, Open the Door of Your Heart. And actually, by the way, the latest translation is in Hebrew. I just got a note the other day that someone's translating to Hebrew. I hope they also translate it to Palestinian as well. And then we got something, maybe open the door of that barrier between Palestine and Israel. But anyhow, one of those stories is a lovely story about a monk, an abbot, who was woken up in the middle of the night. There was some noise coming from the main hall. And it wasn't the monks chanting. So he went to investigate. And of course he found a burglar trying to open up the donation box. And the burglar had a knife and threatened that monk. "Keep away! Otherwise I'll knife you." And the monk only said, "If you wish to open up that donation box, here's the key." And he gave him the key. And he said, "Keep away." And the monk said, "When was the last time you've eaten?" "None of your business." He didn't actually say that. He said something much worse. But this is on camera. And I cannot go too far. And the monk said, "Look, there's some food in the cupboard just above you there, left over from this morning's alms offering. Help yourself." The fellow was hungry. So with one eye on the monk, he sort of grabbed some of the sandwiches and leftover food. And he opened up the donation box, filled his pockets with some of the food, and said, "Don't call the police." He said, "We won't. That's donations. That's for poor people like you. Go in peace. Take them. And take some more food. I won't call the police until much later. I've got to talk to my committee first of all." So off the thief went with the contents of the donation box. And the monk later on talked to his committee about it. And he said, "Much better to have a happy person, a peaceful person. You know, that's usually what happens if somebody steals from us as monks. You know, if we found out that something's been stolen, afterwards we give it to them so they don't make such bad karma. They've got it anyway. So why not donate it to them, if we possibly can?" So a few days later, that thief got caught while robbing another house, as they do. And the monk saw him in the newspapers. He got sentenced to many years in jail. Several years later, when the thief was released from jail, he came back to that temple. He faced that monk again, got out his knife, and said, "Monk, I remembered you from last time. I come here to steal again." The monk just was about to get out the key to the donation box. And the thief said, "Stop it. Last time I realized I stole the wrong thing. I've come here this time," he said, putting away his knife, "to steal your compassion and kindness. I've been thinking about you all the time I was in jail. You never did call the police. You never did threaten me. But you helped me. You were just the kindest person I've ever seen. That's what I want to steal. Your kindness and compassion. Please ordain me as a monk." Isn't that what's really important? That's where that person... It's a mythical story, but I know many other stories where that has happened. I remember the story in the time of Thailand 200 years ago, when a similar thing happened. In those times, in the town of Ayutthaya, monks' temples never had cars because all transport was by rivers and canal. So every monastery would have a boat where they would go for alms round in the morning, and the abbot actually was woken up because someone was rattling the chains, and it was a thief trying to steal a boat. So the abbot told him, "Take it, I give it to you." And in the morning, when there was one boat less and the other monks found out, he said, well, look, somebody was stealing it, he needed it, let's give it to him. We're supposed to be kind and generous, compassionate monks. And so, the next day, people were so impressed with that, like a real monk, who cared more for people than things, that he got about 5 boats donated the next day. So it's also good business sense. Because what's more important in life? What's the purpose of life? Sometimes those acts of kindness and generosity, when they come like that, they're just really amazing to see. And that gives life a purpose. When you question and honest, that generosity. As somebody was asking me, there was going to be some sort of function or conference or speech on organ donation soon. And unfortunately, that's the time when I'll be teaching a 9-day retreat in North Perth. And so I can't go, but I told him, whoever you ask to go there, to tell this following story, which is an inspiring story, again from Sri Lanka. You know that Sri Lanka, being a Buddhist country, has the highest number of organ donors, especially eye donors, in the world, because being Buddhist, we think, well, once we die, we don't need our body anymore. What a wonderful thing to make this wonderful last act of karma and give your organs, whatever you want, to people who need them more than you. And we're not superstitious. You don't say that if you give your eyes, you'll be blind in heaven. Or if you give your legs, you know, you have to be in a wheelchair in heaven. That's ridiculous what some people think. And it's obvious, you know, you will know if you question and be honest. If you give an organ when you're about to die, and in the last moments you're still alive when they take those organs, but you can't feel anything at that time, you're at the end of your life. You know, you're not feeling any pain, so give them whatever you want. Or whatever they want. It's a wonderful gift to others. That's karma, good karma, compassion, generosity. But sometimes people give their organs when they're still alive. Organ donors. Some years ago in Sri Lanka, there was one of these evangelical Christians who was going around converting all the Buddhists to being Christians. He had kidney failure. So they did a match in the island to find a donor. And they found a perfect match with a Buddhist monk. It's like, you know, a West Coast Eagle being asked to give a kidney to a Dockers fan. And they asked him, so look, you know, perfect match. You know, you're a blood donor and we got your blood match and your kidney matches this, you know, Baptist born-again Christian who's going around converting all of your disciples. Will you give your kidney? He said, of course I will. There's no problem whatsoever. It doesn't matter who they are. When you're generous, you give indiscriminately to whoever needs it. And so he went to hospital and he gave his kidney so that the opposition, if you like, and they don't really think of them as opposition, so another person could live. And of course, that got in the newspapers. I even saw it in the newspaper here in the West Australian. And what a wonderful act of charity that is. And, you know, to give to somebody, I was just wondering whether a born-again Christian would actually give their kidney to a Buddhist. If they didn't, they don't know what love is all about. What kindness. Can you see there's something very meaningful in that? There's a generosity of the heart, the selflessness, is what gives our life meaning. And when you start to think of the times in your life which has inspired you the most, which you'd find is most purposeful and most meaningful, they usually are times of selfless compassion and generosity. When you've seen something which needs to be done and someone has just done it. The next story which comes to mind was told by some of our fellow Western monks. The first place we went to start a monastery after living in China for many years, was in England, in London. Now we have many flourishing monasteries in that land, but they're all out in the countryside, in the forest, or in the rural parts of that land, because we're forest monks, and you know, we like to live, you know, next to nature, you know, where there's lots of trees or mountains and wildlife. But when they first arrived in London, they were put in a house in Hampstead, in a suburb just to the north of London. And this monk was telling me just how depressed he was getting, because London is very grey, especially in the winter time. And in fact, many people do get, what is it, seasonally affective disorder. It's called SAD, S-A-D, a nice acronym for the word. In other words, in the northern hemisphere, sometimes the sun doesn't come up till maybe 10 in the morning and goes down again in 2 in the afternoon. There's hardly any light, and it's dull and grey and cold. There's nothing to really sort of enliven you or inspire you. And because of lack of inspiration, that many people get depressed at that time of the year, or they go to the pub and just get drunk or take drugs or whatever. But it was, because this monk was used to the bright forests of Thailand for many, many years, and now he was stuck in a small house, you know, a terraced house, you know, in London. And you say one day he was just looking through the window and just getting more and more bored and saddened and depressed, wondering if he should go back to Thailand. And he noticed this was early in the morning and it was grey and drizzling and cold outside. He noticed just on the opposite side of the street and a few 20-30 meters down, he noticed there was a homeless man hunched in the doorway. He was hunched in the doorway to try and escape as much as possible from the wind, the cold, and especially the rain. And I remember from my own experience living in that town, even though there's much wealth, wherever there's wealth you'll always find great poverty. And there are people who have no place to stay. And I know those people who live on the streets of London, especially in winter, they have to use alcohol to keep warm, and it's usually the very cheapest type of alcohol. What is sold in usually the hardware stores is methylated spirits. And I remember meeting many people who had that problem, being addicted to this very cheap and very dangerous form of alcohol. Stinking, dirty. There's a particular smell I remember from my youth of these people who actually were on the streets taking methylated spirits just to keep a bit warm. And this guy was one of them. And then as this monk was watching him through the drizzling rain, he noticed walking on that side of the street, going towards the doorway where this man was hunched, was a man, well-dressed, going on his way to work. This was several years ago, when people would go to work in the city of London, dressed in their uniform, which was a bowler hat, a nice suit, a briefcase, and an umbrella. It was what you see in the movies sometimes. And this was a man impeccably dressed and groomed on his way to work. And he saw this very well-dressed, clean, well-groomed businessman stop at the doorway and lean over to this poor homeless man, say a few words to him, which he could not hear, and then put his arm around this homeless guy and pick him up and take him to a cafe for breakfast. Even though he knew, as I know, the smell of that man would be on his suit, he'd be late for work. He didn't need to do that, but he did. When this monk told me that story, he said all his depression and boredom disappeared. It was as if the greyness of London suddenly disappeared, and everything was bright. When he saw an unexpected, unneeded act of kindness and compassion, which cost that businessman. Now that's a wonderful thing to see in our life. Now, those are the things which give life meaning. And I ask, have you done that? Have you stopped for someone who really needed you? Doesn't matter how busy you are. If you won't get the sack from work, and if you do get the sack from work, you shouldn't be working for such an ungrateful company. Isn't it wonderful when we can stop and help and be kind? Now that is telling you what the meaning of life is. We question and we're honest. How does that feel when you do an act of kindness like that? An act of goodness, an act of charity, an act of selflessness, something you shouldn't really be doing, but for the heck of it, or the inspiration of it, for the meaning of it, you go ahead and you do it. That's what life is for, to be able to help and serve like that. It's an act of love and compassion. So whenever that opportunity comes, and it only comes rarely, take it, stop, and help. You will never regret it. It will give your life meaning, and it will inspire others to also find that meaning. That's why the compassion, which is the heart of generosity and love, is one of the important meanings of life. Sometimes people think that love just means, you know, the love for your partner. Sure, that gives your life meaning. You know, your partner, which you choose to live with in life. But you know, that type of love, if it doesn't sort of grow and develop into something more selfless, more compassionate, more freeing. I've mentioned here before that the love of a marriage is usually a very selfish love, what you can get out of that partner, what you can get out of that relationship. But if you're very wise and you work at it, your relationship can become something much deeper, more compassionate and more freeing, which is that phrase which I use almost every week to say to your partner, whatever you do, wherever you go, the door of my heart's open to you. To give them a compassion which doesn't ask anything back in return, with no strings tied, no strings attached. Now that's like a compassionate, a high, deep, meaningful love. I say it's the same love which you give your children. No matter where they go, no matter what they do, you really want them to be happy. But if it's with you or with someone else, that's not the most important point. Their happiness is the most important. And if you think that you have that type of love to your partner, a freeing love, you just want them to be happy, that their happiness is the most important thing in the world to you, I ask people to do this following test. This is a little exercise to see what type of love you have to the person you live with. Imagine you come here on a Friday night alone one night, and you hear a talk on loving kindness like this. The door of your heart is open to your partner. Whatever they do, wherever they go, you just want them to be happy, that's all. And when you go home, you find on the front door of your house or apartment there's a note waiting for you from your partner. Say, while you're at the Buddhist temple, I've run off with your best friend. We're now in Cable Beach, Broome, having a dirty weekend, having a wonderful time. Bye-bye. How would you feel? If you really loved your partner, you would think, oh, wonderful, tremendous, they're having such a happy time. In fact, they're having more joy with my best friend than they ever had with me. Oh, your happiness is the most important thing for me, darling. Could you do that? No. So really, that's not true, is it? Your partner's happiness is not the most important thing. But at least it's getting real, because we do have attachments and our needs. And every now and again we can go a bit deeper. And I don't know what it is, but this week we had 4 funerals to go to. And I did 2 of those funerals. And I often mention that story about opening the door of your heart. And to say one of the most meaningful things of life is when you can say to your partner just before they die, go in peace. Go with my blessing. I will miss you, but I love you so much to free you. Now that's a love which is a generous love, which is not wanting something for yourself, because it does hurt when a loved one dies, whether it's your partner, your parent, your son, your daughter, your friend. But it's a wonderful thing to see, you know, when people have enough wisdom to understand the purpose of life is to enjoy the company of your loved ones and then let them go. To give them the ultimate gift of love, to free them. Go in peace, with my blessing. I will always remember you. And I've seen moments like that, especially in funeral services, or just beforehand, And those are things which I really remember as having huge purpose and meaning in life. There's something which is holy in that, really spiritual, which is religious. You know, I find more meaning when I see moments like that than I ever do in any books or any sort of written words. This is life. This is its meaning. This is its purpose. To enjoy and let go. When we understand that, we understand that, yeah, we're here to enjoy these moments, to learn from them, and leave them alone, let them go. We do have much fun in life, but it's also, some part of the purpose is also to understand the pain of life as well. But sometimes, especially young people, they come and say it hurts so much. It hurts terribly when the person they love, they do something wrong or it breaks down. And when relationships don't work out as they should do, or as you think they should do, and you get many, many broken hearts. And that's not just for young people as well. I think many of you have been through breakups of relationships, and it really, really hurts. What's the meaning of that? What's its purpose? Especially for those who are young when they go through their first breakup. I always tell them this, and I tell them this with absolute sincerity. How on earth can you love someone when you haven't known hurt and pain? It's those breakups which tell you how to love, which teach you how to love. Because the breakup comes first, when you realize the pain. And only when you realize the pain can you realize what love is all about. Love is not just having a good time. Love is about being able to embrace those difficult moments. Not just to love the nice stuff, but love the other half of life as well. That's one of the other sayings which I remember from a long ago. People say they love life, but really most of us only love and accept the good part of life, the pleasant part. And the part which is a bit painful to bear or difficult to bear, we look at that as some big mistake, something wrong which is to be fixed. But after a while, especially of questioning and being honest, we find that the pain and difficulties of life are actually part of life. It's not as if something goes wrong. This is part of the whole journey. And we can't expect life to be any different. Somebody, I mentioned this last week to the monks, when they asked me a quick definition of suffering in Buddhism. What is suffering? And I answered them straight away because they were in a hurry like most people are. Actually, I was in a hurry as well, so I couldn't give a long explanation. I said, "Sir, suffering is asking from life what it can never give you. Asking from life what it can never give you." And if you look, every time you suffered today or last week, I was suffering today because going through our monastery and our retreat center, there is a road reserve, you know, which was supposed to be connecting some neighbor's land. It was never made up, but we had to excise it from the land so we can build our retreat center over it. And so I started a whole process about 18 months ago. And now we're getting so close to building, it's crunch time. The bureaucrats, you know, in the lands office or whatever, they were taking such a long time. I was ringing them up and faxing them and doing all sorts of things, and only today I went there and got sort of an offer and acceptance from them. I had to do it myself. It's taken so long. I think, why does that have to happen? And I realized that I was asking from life what it can never give me. How can you ever ask for bureaucrats to do things on time? Now, I'm asking for suffering, aren't I? When you ask from life what it can never give you, that's suffering. When you ask from your partner what they can never give you. Now, why are you always like this, darling? Of course they're going to have their bad moods and their good moods. So you accept your partner for who they are. Otherwise you'll suffer. You know, asking from yourself. You can ask from yourself what you can never give yourself. You're always going to be in a tired sometimes, a bad mood sometimes, a good mood sometimes. Sometimes you're going to stuff up and make big mistakes. But if you ask for perfection from yourself, then you're asking what you can never give yourself. No wonder you get suffering and get upset. So suffering is asking from life what life can never give you. Asking from another person what they can never give you. And especially asking from yourself what you will never be able to supply. So a lot of understanding the meaning of life is understanding what life is and what it can give, what it can't give. What it can't give is everything you want. Sometimes you get what you want. Sometimes you'll just have to bear with it for a while. And this one particular man I said this afternoon was worrying about the pain in his body. He's getting quite old. Now how can you ask for a healthy body as you get into 60s and 70s and 80s? No more than you can ask that your car will never break down. Especially when it's 5, 10 years of age, 15 years of age. What do you expect? Your car is rusting. It's falling apart. It's decaying. Just like you. You're falling apart. You're decaying. And some of you here are decaying quite a lot. Me included. Now if you ask from life, your body, what it can never give you, that's called suffering. So you can expect to be, you know, slower, sicker, forget things. Now you do sort of forget things. An old friend we saw today, I've known him for many, many years at the funeral service. It's amazing how many old people you meet at funeral services. Some are usually so old, you wonder why they leave the chapel. They should just stay there. Time's coming soon. I remember hearing that joke from someone else. Very funny. But he left his car keys, you know, on the sort of seat. And of course, you know, well, he's in his 80s now, 90s, I think. So what do you expect, leaving your car keys all over the place? So you know, you'd be embarrassed about that. If you're embarrassed, it's called suffering. So just accept the fact you forget things now and again. And that's just old age. Isn't that wonderful? It'd be wonderful if we can actually forget the right things. And I forget all the sort of the pain of the past, the difficulties of the past. Now, if you forget the right thing, I think Alzheimer's is very close to enlightenment sometimes, I think, being in the present moment. You don't have to worry about a thing, everyone else worries about you. But a lot of times people don't want to be like that. And it's not wanting it, it's just like the pain in the body. You know, we have to accept and embrace pain sometimes. Sometimes there are pains which you can fix up. So you go to the doctor, you get medication, you do some mind meditation or medication, or whatever you do. Sometimes you can fix up pains in the body, but sometimes there's things you just can't fix. Why? What's the meaning of that? The meaning of that is to learn, to embrace the unpleasant part of life as well as the pleasant part. To love both. And it's wonderful and amazing actually to see people have done that. Even though they are in great pain, they can be at peace. Just again in Singapore, there was one lady, she was following me around Malaysia, when I was there a couple of weeks ago. Followed me around from talk to talk to talk to talk. When she came up eventually to say why, and it was one of these other cases, she said, "Thank you for saving my life." It was always wonderful when that happens, because they really mean it. And because of the teachings which I'd given over the many years, she fell over and sort of had a very bad accident, and she was in very, very bad pain for 3 months while her shoulder and hip or whatever else healed up. She could not sleep, so she'd end up pacing her house during the middle of the night. But because of the teachings of just letting go, being mindful, being peace, not wanting anything else, not expecting anything else, she said she could give up all her medication, all her painkillers, and even though her body was in pain, her mind was at peace. And she said she never believed it could be done until she did it. And she did it because it was suggested, you know, by monks like me. And we gave her the means to do that. Stop fighting, make peace. Open the door of your heart to the physical feelings of pain. You can't go to sleep. Don't want to go to sleep. Just work with what you have rather than fight against it. Make peace in every moment. Stop worrying about the future. Just stay in this moment. For 3 months she did that. Now she's totally healed, she can sleep again. But for that time of great pain, she could do it. And she was amazed at herself. And the reason she could do it, because she found teachings such as these. And those teachings gave her the understanding of why we have physical pain. Physical pain, disappointments in life, broken hearts, tragedies, deaths. In Buddhism we call these messengers of truth. In the traditional story, before the person who became the Buddha and sat under those Bodhi trees, he saw old man, sick man, dead man and holy man. Especially the first three, they're called messengers of truth. They really made it sure that everyone gets old, everyone gets sick, everyone gets dies. And that was really quite an important lesson for him. Know that sickness is not something which is wrong. Sickness is part of life. That old story I told here, and I know that you follow these stories because a doctor told me this. They said this person came into my room, and I told him that it was, got this disease or that disease. And the person said, "Oh, doctor, there's something right with me. I'm sick again." And he said, "And I've heard that from Ajahn Brahm. You must go to Nonwa." I said, "Yeah, I go to Nonwa every week because that's one of my stories." Hands up, anyone here who's never been sick. Put your hand up if you've never been sick in your life. No one's got their hand up. You've all been sick from time to time. Actually, it would be quite unusual and very strange if at your age you'd never had any sickness. You'd be a freak. So because everyone in this hall has been sick, sickness is normal. It's par for the course. It's usual. So why is it that when you're sick, we say, "Doctor, there's something wrong with me. I'm sick." There's nothing wrong with being sick. There'd be something very wrong if you've never been sick. That's why I say you'd be a freak. You'd be unnatural. You'd probably be from Mars or somewhere, an alien in our midst. So because sickness is normal, sickness is okay. It's right. Which is why I told everyone who comes here, next time you go to the doctor because you've got some sort of illness, you should go to your doctor and say, "Doctor, there's something right with me. I'm sick again." Now, what I'm saying there is very deep because we have this psychological negativity to some of the painful experiences of life, like sickness, or a bad shoulder, or arthritis, or death. Or, we lose our job, or we lose the loved one. Why do we have this psychological negativity? Can we actually say, "There's something wrong with me, Ajahn Brahm. Now my partner has left me. There's something wrong with me, I've got sacked. There's something wrong that somebody has died." Now you see that when you say there's something wrong, that gives the psychological negativity to the experience of life. Instead of learning from life, we're in denial about life, and we're missing its purpose and meaning. So when we tend to actually become real and say, "This is part of life, it's not something that's gone wrong. This is the life of a human being." When we understand that, we understand that yes, these are things to be accepted, to be learned from. And what we learn from the painful part of life is how to appreciate the pleasant part, how to bear with that which is what we don't like, and learn how to be content no matter what's happening. When things are painful and difficult, when the life is black and dark, we can still have a peaceful heart. We can't control the world, but certainly we can always control the way we regard it, the way we react to it, what we think about it. The world just goes according to nature. but we can always adapt our attitude. And that's one of the wonderful things which I've learned as a monk. The purpose of life is learning what we call right view, changing our attitude to things. When I see someone dying, I think it's a beautiful experience. You may think I'm weird, but sometimes being counseling people at the end of their life, it's like I compare it to sort of the last part of a great symphony. I remember when I used to go to these great symphonies, one of my favorites, Grieg's Piano Concerto. At the very end, everything came together, this beautiful last little portion where all the different themes just came together, this crescendo at the very end, and it was finished. And that was like a person's life. The very end, when all their loved ones are around them, remembering all the things they've done, this beautiful finale of your life. Wow, that was amazing. And being like a monk, I'm privileged to be there at many people's finales. Please invite me to yours. And of course, afterwards, we have the funeral service. I love funeral services. I don't know why people don't like them, because people start talking, they come to my ones anyway, people start talking these amazing stories about people's lives and how much they meant. It really understands the meaning of life. Sometimes those funerals are much better than coming here on a Friday evening. In fact, I should put those funerals down in the sort of the upcoming sort of events so people can actually go to them, take time off instead of coming here. Because there's something beautiful about that. Sometimes in the pain of life, when people are sick, sometimes it's great seeing people are really sick and just seeing what they can do with that. This inspired me so many times. People dying of cancer who smile and laugh. People in great pain who just look at you and you can see that inside they're at peace. It's amazing what I've seen, what can be done. When you understand that, you understand the purpose of life is learning about that. Learning how it's done. And this is how it is done. Stop trying to change the outside. When you're sick, you have that pain. And trying to get rid of it just makes it worse. When you see someone dying, all the tears in the world will never bring them back. And sometimes when people break up in a relationship, they always say, oh, at least we can be good friends. Yeah, sure. When it's gone, it's gone. It's wonderful if we can learn how to change our attitude to some of the difficult things in life, to embrace, accept, forgive, and move on. And never carry the pain of the past, not even into the next moment, let alone into the next week, but to use that pain. You know, that story of digging in the dog shit under your mango tree. And this is what the meaning is. To get sweet mangoes, we need heaps and heaps of dog shit. Especially here in Perth, because the soil is not that good. So the more you can actually dig under the tree, the sweeter your mangoes. And now you know what I'm talking about, the meaning of life. Those pain and difficult experiences which we all experience from time to time, that's what makes you sweet and juicy. That's why the difficulties you have in your marriage, if you know how to dig them in, rather than throw the shit at each other, dig it in under the mango tree, then you can actually get this beautiful, sweet relationship. When you know how the pain of life works, you can get incredible, powerful, beautiful compassion and wisdom. So now you know what the meaning of life is. All of these experiences you have, they're your teachers. They're showing you something, pointing to the messengers of truth. And your job is to make peace with the truth of your life. Also, the happy parts of your life, make peace with those as well. Don't rush through them too fast. Just linger and taste them. When you're having a good time, well done. Please enjoy it and don't rush too far. Don't expect those happy moments to last forever. When we expect those happy moments to last forever, again, we're asking something which life can never give us, permanent happiness. When we know they're not going to last forever, when we know the relationship's never always going to be like this, the children we have are soon going to grow up and leave, our bodies are going to get sicker and older. So when people have their birthday, I always tell them, look, you're not as young as you used to be, but you're not as old as you're going to be. So enjoy today while you still can. So when you think like that, that positive attitude, you're not as old as you're going to be. You know, you're not as fit as you're going to be. You're not as clear and you've not got as good memory as you're going to have in a few years' time. And make use of it while you have it. This is why we can enjoy this moment when we realize it's going to pass. If you think it's going to be here forever, you don't enjoy it as much. Which is why we have this wonderful attitude even to the happy times of life. To embrace them, be at peace with them, knowing they're not going to last. That impermanence, that wisdom, that selflessness gives us a wonderful meaning. Basically, because the time is going, what we're finding is compassion and kindness. Understanding what life can give us and what it can't gives us the deepest meaning of life, which is the peace of mind. You can make peace with everything, no matter what you have to experience. And that is the greatest gift of all, to have this amazing peace, so that when life is going well, you're at peace. When life is difficult, you can even find peace there. When you've got a bad body which is really aching and in pain, you can still make peace with it. You can laugh at everything with a peaceful mind. And if you can find that peace of mind in the middle of life, and of course, you can easily find peace of mind when you meditate. All of you who were meditating for half an hour, were you struggling? Why do people struggle when they're meditating? Because you're asking too much. You're asking from your meditation, from your life, what it can never give you. May I become enlightened this afternoon, please, this evening? Because tomorrow, I've got a busy day. Can we get enlightened now, please, 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 please? In a week or two's time, I'm teaching a meditation retreat for 9 days. Fortunately, there's not a money-back guarantee. Otherwise, many people ask their money back. No, don't expect so much. Don't ask for so much from this very moment. Make peace, not war. I used to be a young hippie. I didn't take drugs, but I still had the long hair and the frayed jeans. And I used to go around in the late 60s with my fingers up like this, you remember? Make peace, not war, make peace, not war. I haven't changed. I just understand what peace is a bit more deeply. So don't make war with your life. Don't make war with your partner. Don't make war with your body if it's getting sick. Make peace. Make peace, not war. And you find you can make peace with your life, with your old age. You can even make peace with death. But don't make war with it. When you can make peace, you're understanding the mind, where peace is made, is far more important than this body. You find by cultivating the mind with peace, not war, you'll find the deepest meaning of all in life, the beautiful peace of mind. We ever ask people to find peace of body? We never say that's an important part of life. Peace of body, what does that mean? We only say peace of mind. That's the purpose of life. To find that the purpose is gaining peace of mind. Not just in a monastery when things are going well, but find peace of mind anywhere, no matter what's happening in life. And the promise is, yes, it can be done. And there you are. You have the meaning of life. Peace of mind. Thank you. So, does anyone want to give me a piece of their mind? Any questions or comments about the talk this evening? There's a question over there, yes? Open the door of your heart. Japanese. No need to, because I don't know what happens. This is that book, Open the Door of Your Heart. It's now been, if I can remember all these, it's now been translated into Indonesian, Korean, Chinese, Thai, Sri Lankan, Russian, Hebrew is the latest one, Danish, Dutch, Portuguese, German, Czech. Yeah, thank you. But I don't know. Sometimes these people just send me these new editions. If there's any Italians here, Mindfulness book, Mindfulness Bliss and Beyond, we've got a copy in the reference library in Italian. I don't understand a word of it, but that's what it says in the front there. So I don't know if it has been yet. I'm sure it will be sooner or later. So it's a wonderful thing to have that, you know, book actually translated into many languages, because it has helped many people. That's why, I don't know if I told this story last week or whatever, but about 4 or 5 weeks ago, a lady came from Germany, all the way to my Perth. No, from Switzerland. She made the journey all the way from Switzerland to Australia for one reason, that was to see me, to say thank you for that book. Because she had anxiety disorders, depression, was under a psychiatrist for many months, all types of medication. And somebody gave her a copy of that book in German. And she read it, and within a few weeks, her psychiatrist told her, "You don't need to see me anymore." Medication was stopped. She was completely healed. Just like a change in attitude towards the things in life was much more powerful than the medication. So the psychiatrist said, "Don't need me. You're free. You're okay." And so she decided to spend the money to get an airfare all the way to Perth just to come and see me in my monastery. Fortunately, I was there, which was a lucky thing. And she came up and she had she got a German edition of the book, and it was all battered because she'd been reading it, and she told me that this book had saved her life. And she said, I always remember this, she said, "Would you mind so much, would you be offended if I asked you to sign it for me?" I said, "Of course not, I'll sign heaps." So I signed it, and I was watching her as I was signing it, she started to cry. Because it meant so much to her, and that meant so much to me. That's the meaning of life. You know that. It feels real, holy, spiritual. And that's what temples of religions should be really about. Just those moments when you've really given without expecting anything, when it's really changed someone's life, when they know how to make peace with the most difficult parts of their life, and they're free. Wow, that's really cool. Okay, I don't know if so no Japanese yet, but any Japanese people get translated. So thank you again for coming. We're going a bit late now, so if you have any other questions, please come up and ask them personally. Remember what I said, honesty and questioning are encouraged.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Sovakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sankhang Namami.